Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, everybody. Hey, monkeys.
What's up?
Welcome to Snark Monkey number 38 with Jack Epps Jr. And first off, let me welcome anyone who might be attending the Los Angeles Podcast Festival this weekend. As I record this and as I post this episode on Saturday, it is the weekend of the PodFest in Los Angeles, I believe the fourth annual. I am in attendance, although not currently, because even at 9 a.m. Pacific time, as I have come to learn, and I totally relate to, podcasters tend to be late risers because they can be. So the podcast festival doesn't even really get going until noon today. So I'm posting this now, and if by chance I have met you at the LA PodFest this weekend and I've forced my business card upon you and told you about my podcast and you're happening to listen to the latest episode, welcome. By the way, make sure you follow me on Twitter at the Snark Monkey, also on the Facebook, and you can subscribe on iTunes or it's on iHeartRadio or on the website at snarkmonkey.net, which is probably maybe where you're listening right now if I forced my card upon you. Okay, so back to business. Great conversation here. Another USC guy, actually a current USC muckety-muck, Jack Epps Jr., heading up the writing department at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. He has some sort of fancy title that we talk about here at the beginning. I say he heads up the writing department. That sounds right. But here's the point. Jack Epps was involved in some of the biggest screenplays in the 80s. Top Gun? Anybody? Heard of it? Have you heard of it? Also, he wrote Legal Eagles, which was a Robert Redford, Daryl Hannah vehicle that Ivan Reitman directed. The Secret of My Success with Michael J. Fox, a huge 80s comedy. A wide range of stuff. Now, I immediately want to upfront apologize. Two titles I did not ask him about, and I regret it now in hindsight, and I'm hoping there will be a Jack Epps Jr. Part 2, because we never covered Turner and Hooch, the Tom Hanks dog cop movie, where the dog dies, and spoiler alert, the dog dies at the end, sorry, and Anaconda, Anna freaking Conda. I'm telling you right now, I hope I'm learning something at the podcast festival this weekend, because that is a terrible podcast moderator to not cover Turner and Hooch and Anaconda. I got to Dick Tracy, the Warren Beatty movie, with like every other human being alive at the time, including Madonna, Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino. But no, didn't talk Turner and Hooch and didn't talk Anaconda. I regret it. However, this is a really great discussion about the art and craft of screenwriting. He's got a book coming out, Jack does, called Screenwriting is Rewriting. And he's all about the discipline and tenacious nature of writing that doesn't sound or even feel that arty, but it's kind of the point. He and his partner Jim Cash went through, well, you'll hear about it. How long it took them to actually get their first screenplay produced, how much work they put in to get to that point. And I believe it's probably even tougher now than it was for them then. How about I shut up now, since I've already proven and admitted to being a terrible podcasting, you know, host thing. See, I can't even talk. What am I doing? I need to go back. Okay, I'm going to head to the podcast festival. I'm going to take a seminar. And next episode will be so much better because of what I learned. Hey, thanks to the Los Angeles Podcast Festival for hosting such a cool event. I hope that I get a lot out of it. I'm not sure yet. Haven't even really got there. Again, things don't get going until noon. I'm going to see if I can heckle Marc Maron. Now, why would I do that? Why would I do that? I just want attention. All right, here's Snark Monkey number 38, Jack Epps Jr. Sign in. State your name, sir.
My name is Jack Epps Jr.
Oh, we're doing
a little on the side.
Okay,
closer to your mouth.
Sort of like dental X-rays.
Exactly.
Yeah, the molar back here, Doc, is giving me really pain. You know what I mean?
That's right. Now here, let me put the leaded vest on you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And I'll
much.
Go in the other room.
Yeah.
Isn't that
the?
That's one of the scariest things in modern science, where somebody puts a lead vest on you that you feel the weight.
Yeah.
They jam this thing in your mouth that's very uncomfortable every time I've ever done it, point obviously very powerful x-rays up to your face, and then they go around a leaded wall to be away from it and click a millisecond of an x-ray.
Probably because they're making the cavities are going to fill right there. See, that's the scheme. We think it's x-rays, but it's actually a cavity-making machine.
Now, see, it was such a simple conspiracy to think that dentists gave you candy on the way out just because they wanted to develop more bad habits. But I guess in these healthier times...
That's right, exactly.
They're just shooting, deteriorating x-rays in your face. Jack Epps Jr., a delight to talk to you. There's so much to cover here. And let's, first of all, start... what is your title right now at USC?
My title right now is I'm an associate professor and chair of the Writing for Screen and Television Division at the School of Cinematic Arts. Yes.
Does that all fit on your business card?
It does. It's a very big card. It's an 8x10.
Okay. So yeah.
It lights up, too. The card sort of blinks.
Oh, wow. Neon and everything. Yeah. So you went big card as opposed to tiny print. I think that's smart.
Yeah, exactly.
That's good. Right. That's a big deal. And USC, more than ever... You know, when I attended USC 1980 to 85-ish, and it was a big deal then because people had first started discovering USC, that film schools even existed, thanks to one Mr. Lucas and others who had become that new breed of filmmaker, and there was this mad rush. It was the new rock and roll. If there was rock and roll in the 80s, that was it. It has maintained that level to the point now where it's basically the film school, right?
Well, it really is, because it covers so much. You know, film school tends to think of film, but it's actually today it's television. It's all media. It's interactive gaming because it's entertainment, and it's all so blended together today. I mean, it used to be simple when it was a film school, but now it's truly a media school. And the challenge of all these programs is to stay current because things keep changing all the time. You know, product, delivery, screens, what does it all mean?
Yeah, and technology. So, I mean, across the board, I mean, you've probably seen just in the last 5 years alone, just the delivery method of content is so vastly different. Right. And that, I think this would be an interesting conversation, that actually affects the kind of content being created.
It does.
I mean, I was just comparing notes with somebody. I think I even talked to somebody about it on this podcast, Trey Calloway. I've been binge-watching The Walking Dead. I'm finally catching up on it. That show, I don't think, was designed for binge-watching because I got really depressed. I mean, I think you can handle doses of it once a week, but... I don't know that anybody was thinking from a content standpoint that relentless nature of what's going on in that show, how it would impact people. While other shows that are lighter or even a House of Cards that has kind of a through story, you know, a string going through there, they must be thinking differently as they create this content, knowing people might sit down for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours to watch it.
Well, I think that Breaking Bad was the show that changed that, and that means it was Netflix then that changed it because people get all these discs and watch them at home.
Right.
And that was it happened by accident. Vince Gilligan said the reason the show stayed in the air was because Netflix came out and people could binge watch it, and then they caught up to the show. Otherwise, he felt it wouldn't have been on as long.
That's right. Yeah, because it wasn't exactly doing that well. It
had
this odd reputation, but when people did find it via Netflix, you're absolutely right.
So that's actually technology. I mean, it seems like DVD, but how it's delivered and how it comes to the home, which then leads to streaming, which then leads to a whole different approach. And then, of course, there's web content. So, you know, and that's different, too, because what's a webisode? We actually teach webisodes, writing webisodes and producing and directing webisodes. And because it's a very different format. that in terms of what you're delivering in a very short period of time.
So do you see young people coming in with this attitude? Certainly when I was there, the TV wasn't even very well respected. It was all about, I want to write movies, I want to make movies, I want to be a movie director or producer. Do you see them coming in with this idea that I'm good with making short content, I'm okay with making stuff for a website? Do you see that change, or is there still this kind of focus on the movies, or is it spread across?
It's really spread across, and you know, every student's a little bit different. Depends on what they come in. I mean, there's grads and undergrads, and those are two different types of student. So for the undergrads, they're much more media savvy. They watch a lot more online, so they're focused to making more online series. In terms of our writing students, they really love television right now. So they're coming there to study TV, which we in the last 5 years have totally revised our curriculum. So it's we focus on television in a big way. Episodic, pilot writing, creating series. I mean, it's something that is exciting. There was a stat that it's believed that there are over 400 episodes of prime time scripted television on this year.
Now, give me that again.
400 episodes of primetime scripted television.
Wow.
Yep.
And I'm sure that's a record. That's unprecedented, I would imagine.
It absolutely is.
And I want to go back a little bit, and we'll talk about your project here, because that looks fascinating. We'll circle back around to that.
All right.
But I want to talk about you as a there it is. Screenwriting is rewriting.
Oh, thank you.
Wow. Yeah. I coined that just now myself.
Yeah.
You can use that if you like.
Well, thank you.
But you started as a writer, and you came out of television, correct? You did some television.
I did. You know, I came up to California. I came out actually to be a director, like everybody in the early 70s. It was new wave directors, and so that was
exciting. Is that who flipped the switch for you, that you were watching Truffaut?
Those things. Suddenly, you know, cinema was alive, and there were reasons to go to movies, and they really change your life, and there's a lot of things being said, and I wanted to be that person who created those, you know, those movies. And I love holding a camera and shooting a camera. It's a very new wave in terms of all that stuff.
The handheld, you mean?
Absolutely.
Kind of rougher style.
Well, being involved in, you know, that's part of film is great, because you're sort of, there's this dance that goes on, that you're part of this wonderful choreographed dance. But coming out to California, you know, I had no money. I was from Michigan.
You grew up in Michigan?
Yes, grew up in Detroit.
What? Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Give me a little sense of what it's like to grow up in Detroit. I've talked to other people from there. I don't know that people today, they immediately think, you know, a terrible, depressed, crime-ridden city, which it may very well be, and it's struggling to kind of come back from that. But it's always had a reputation as a rough urban town.
Well, you know, Detroit in the 50s and 60s was an amazing place. It, not only was it the center of car culture,
sure,
and wonderful cars in the 50s and 60s. So as a kid growing up there, I mean, you just watched. I knew every car and every model. And I mean, you just knew this.
Yeah, they were rolling right off the line and onto the streets.
And if you didn't have a new car every year, you were out of fashion.
Really?
Because, cars.
That was a thing.
Cars are fashion style, and therefore you want to have that latest Cadillac or that latest Chevy Bel Air or whatever it was going to be.
So your family did?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we did. We had a 59 Caddy with the long fins in the back, all that sort of
Beautiful.
Stuff. It was great. And Detroit was also great because of the music center. I mean, not only with Motown, everybody knows Motown, but also a huge jazz center.
Right.
There was a lot of rock and roll, Bob Seger. So music and cars and a lot of beer, you know, because it was a very blue-collar culture. People worked really hard during the week, and the whole point of the week was to find the party on the weekend.
Yeah, but it was still reflected in the arts, reflected it, and the business reflected
absolutely.
That. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it was also a movie town. We had, because Detroit was built in the 20s, so in fact it still is a 20s town. So we had huge movie palaces, the Fox Theater, the Michigan, Cinerama. I mean, so part of my culture of growing up was to see big screen movies.
Yeah.
I mean,
event movies.
Event movies, but also put on a theaters built in the 20s. Much like if you do the L.A. Conservatory tour of Broadway theaters, which is really, I highly recommend. It's the same sort of thing. Here, a lot have been turned into churches, which actually preserves the theater, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And so it was an interesting place to grow up.
What did your parents do?
My dad was, depending upon the year, he did many things.
Really?
Yeah. He started in the brewery supply business. Selling malt, hops, grain, okay? And then he moved into building motels and hotels and built them and ran them for a while and ended up in scrap steel business. I mean, just he was that guy.
Jack of all trades, kind of hopped around.
Yeah, sort of just different things, yeah. Where things went, sold the hotels, bought this, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was interesting.
And mom was homemaker?
Yeah, homemaker. I mean, she was a candy striper, worked at a hospital. So, you know, that's how she gave back.
Any showbiz leanings anywhere in the family?
Well, showbiz leanings, we would always go to New York a lot and see opening Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. And my folks are great, and they didn't really stick as a babysitter. So my sister and I went and saw, like, Sound of Music, Broadway cast, West Side Story, Broadway cast. I mean, just great, great shows. Gypsy with Ethel Merman. I can do a pretty good Ethel Merman impersonation.
Oh, don't even throw that out there without thinking that you're going to get called on that a little bit, Jack.
Exactly.
All right, we'll see how we get along here in a little while.
That's right, okay.
So you were drawn to live theater quite a bit. Did you have aspirations?
Well, I wasn't drawn to it as much because what I did was part of this entertainment, this sort of bravado, this sort of largeness that Broadway gave,
right?
And then influenced by a lot of just big theater in Detroit and movies, and you know, I was raised on basically the same popcorn movies everybody else was at that time.
So when the new wave guys came around, you've already talked about big event movies, big theater,
sure.
Kind of these big splashy, flashy things. What kind of kid were you as you were growing up? Were you just a normal kid? Were you an athlete? Were you a good student?
You know, I played ice hockey.
Yeah.
It actually saved my life in a sense. You know, as a kid, unless you find something to grip onto and sort of focus on.
And be a part of something.
Being part of a team, which was a huge, great experience. And my position was a goaltender, so it was, you know, be part of a team and that last guy, which I sort of always liked.
I
didn't have to sit in the bench. You know, I was always on the ice all the time.
Oh, that's
great. Which was my idea of a good time.
All right, so you were part of a group, so you were accepted, and you weren't some sort of loner outsider type.
Yeah.
But did you have a creative bent somewhere in there?
When I was really about 13, a friend of mine got me excited about guitars, and I started playing guitar, and Bob Dylan came out, first album, you know, Freewheeling came out at that time, and so it was young Bob Dylan sitting in my room at night and just writing songs. So for years, I just wrote songs. Never showed them to anybody, just wrote them in a book, but actually, that was my initial writing.
In poetry, in a sense, you were thinking in terms of
lyric.
Yeah.
Just lyric and trying to, you know, very Dylan-esque and trying to, you know, create those meaningful songs and stuff like that.
So what motivated you to pick up from that environment, blue-collar Michigan, you've got a little bit of creative something going on there. What made you say, I'm going to go up and go to Los Angeles?
A couple of things. So one thing I neglected in terms of the backstory was my dad at one point owned a camera store. And he ended up with two projectors and a Bolex camera. And he converted our back room into a little movie theater. He even had pictures that would swing out. So there was the projection booth and swing closed.
Oh, wow.
So he used to get – he knew the Columbia distributor and used to get prints to show at the house. So we would have screenings at my house of movies, which was – now it's like, okay, everybody's watching movies.
Sure.
But at that time, having a movie in your house was really exciting.
And having a de facto screening room.
Absolutely.
Really,
hit a big screen and the whole thing. And
oh,
so, I mean, he was
great.
That sort of, you know, little guy who would do those things.
Yeah.
You know, had an editor in the back, little things to splice movies when they broke. And
right.
So as a kid, one, seeing movies in the home was very informing. Being in the projection booth was even more fun because, to me, it was a great place to watch a movie. Because there's a projector in all its majesty with the film going through it, and making a sound and the light flashing. And the film smells quite wonderful. Warm film. It's hard to explain. But it does.
It's really hard to explain now because it's so uncommon.
Absolutely.
Because when I was part of my work study program at USC, I worked for the cinema department for a while projecting films.
Sure.
And
right.
Drew Casper and a bunch That's of those right. guys. And I would sit in the, especially in the warmer months, very, 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 very
right.
warm booths,
yeah.
Changing reels. But it is. You're still enjoying the film. You're still watching the film. But there is this kind of... It, more than tactile kind of
Absolutely.
Experience of being in the room
right.
where that image is coming right. from.
It's another level of film because you're actually with the film itself. You know what I mean? The whole hard
yeah.
film.
Yeah, you're like a part of it.
Yeah. So I learned when I was younger, like 13 or something, how to thread the projector.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a breakthrough when I look back at it because threading a projector – was I could show films to my friends, and so I started screening whatever we had, home movies. My dad had a Bolex. We took a bunch of 60-millimeter home movies and
uh-huh.
spliced them together. So I was at Michigan State, and I was taking creative writing. I actually went there as a zoology major, a pre-med. Yes.
Wow. Now, where did that come from?
Well, we were all doing it. Well, you know, all your friends.
Crazy kids back there, you know, listen to Dylan, smoke a little pot, study animals. Of course.
Well, it was an 8 a.m. chemistry class that just blew me out. You know, Michigan State is like a headwind. It's snowing. I didn't make many of those. And so I realized that, you know, I wrote a short story in a class, and it was actually quite good. It was by accident. I was trying to write Hemingway, and I was writing this Hemingway thing. But I thought I needed a couple bottles of wine to write like Hemingway. Got sloshed. What I wrote that night was horrible, but I wrote about the hangover, which was actually pretty good. I actually wrote a very good hangover story.
Oh, great!
So, yeah, exactly. So I said, "Wow, I can get a degree if I just do writing. I can keep doing this." And so I switched over to creative writing. And spent time, you know, just working on trying to be a writer, realizing that it was really hard, and I wasn't that good at it. But went to a film festival at Michigan State, student film festival, looked at the work, came out and said to a friend, I can do better than that.
Ah.
Next year I went to student
didn't
film.
Didn't seem so hard, did it?
Didn't seem so hard. Made a film, took a class, made a film. And literally, I had a great time making the film, and literally showing the film and stepping into the class to talk about the film afterwards, my life changed. That I had communicated through this film in a way that I never could communicate through a song, through a story, through a pantry painting. I couldn't work there, but here I suddenly communicated to an audience in a way that was life-changing. And their response was really amazing. And so I made three short films at Michigan State. They all won awards at different film festivals and stuff like that. And said, well, I'm going out to California. I really want to make movies.
So you found the way to connect to people in a creative way. And it seems like it came kind of late. Like you discovered this skill.
Oh, right. As a junior, almost a senior, I stayed an extra year at Michigan State just because I could get access to equipment.
Yeah.
And at that time, making films was really expensive.
All right. So you come out of making these movies, getting great response, winning some awards.
Right.
You are young. How old are you?
22.
All right. So you are filled with spit and vinegar and hubris, and you're going to take Hollywood by storm, right?
I think I was going to come out here and just like try to find my place in it.
All right.
And
so you didn't have your chest puffed out expecting kind of big things happening right away.
No, I didn't. I expected I had, I was going to have to pay a lot of dues to get there.
All right.
But I think the
self-aware than most 22-year-olds coming to L.A., by the way.
Well, I think part of it being a hands-on filmmaker, making documentaries, spending a lot of time in the editing room, knowing how hard it was, and part of the mystery that everybody goes, well, how do I go from being this little guy in Michigan to directing for the studios? And how do you make a movie for them? I mean, you know, that's a lot to figure out.
Yeah. Okay. I get that now because you're right. When I came to USC, it was so geared toward a direct pipeline to the industry because it was right there. And you had people who worked in it in Michigan, at Michigan State, probably not the same sensibility.
No.
Yeah. No. So what was your first step?
Get a job.
and did you?
Yeah, you know, I wrote about 60 letters to get a job carrying cables and just being a grip because also assistant cameraman because that was a skill set I had. So part of it was trying to pay rent and just try to get my feet landed. And the other thing was I knew that I wasn't going to get paid to direct, so the best thing to do is to start writing scripts because that's how you direct on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, I was directing on paper.
All right. So what would you say, Jack, was the thing that got you your first big break? I mean, what was the door opening? Who was the champion? What was that flashpoint moment for you?
You know, it's interesting because I think opportunity is built on many steps.
Right.
It's a series of being open to possibilities, taking advantage of what seems to be a path, whether it's a path you plan or not, and then following up on the other opportunity. Interesting enough, I had written some scripts. They weren't very good because I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and it was hard to get scripts at that time. Nothing was online. To get a script, you actually had to, you know, make an exchange because they weren't floating all over town.
Right.
So we traded scripts and stuff. So interesting enough, I got an internship through the AFI as an outpatient. I wasn't registered as a student. I just walked in the door and said, hey, I'd like an internship. They said, fine, great. It was amazing. And they set me up with Tony Bill on a movie called Hearts of the West, Howard Zeif directing and Jeff Bridges. And I was an intern on that production for close to 6 months, 3 months pre-production, then on production. And that sort of changed everything because for me as a kid from Michigan, suddenly I was on an MGM stages every day, mm-hmm. watching a movie get shot you know, shot by pickup by pickup, and seeing this entire process. And the light bulb went on in the middle, as I said, you know, everybody's looking at those actors. The cameras are focused on those. And everything is about them. So if you're writing a script, it better be about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of, it informed my approach to writing. Is I've got to write performance. I've got to write things for actors to play.
So
to write
looking
roles.
Back, what were your earlier scripts doing that didn't satisfy that?
Oh, they're about ideas and stuff, and there's mm-hmm. no characters, and it was pretty much, you know, the stuff of these, more imagistic than it was about examining this path that we were on.
Right. So the structure of a character or characters and that arc and watching their specific personal journey wasn't
yes.
present in those parts.
Exactly.
So
and then the other great thing, before I get my partner, Jim Cash, I worked with Anderson House, and we sold a television show episodic to Kojak at that time. We sold the treatment but could not get the screenplay. So that was so disappointing. We kept pitching and pitching and came back, and they just had somebody else wrote the screenplay. So I'm watching that Kojak, and I was sitting there watching the show. We had the treatment idea, story by. And I watched what another writer did to it, and I realized that all we had been pitching was the plot. And this other writer wrote this intricate story about this person going through a crisis. And that was another great lesson painful, but it was a great lesson of realizing that it's about the people.
Well, it was important, again, I see this kind of lack of hubris on your part to go, oh, they destroyed our whatever. But you recognized what element was missing from your efforts.
I didn't intend to. It sort of hit me like a ton of bricks where I had missed it. I tell my students, I truly believe in it. You learn more from failure than success. You don't learn a lot when you succeed, because when you succeed, you're all taken with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm really brilliant.
Yeah.
But when you fail, you go back and say, oh, why didn't this work? What happened here? And it produces opportunities for growth.
Well, you also have to have it in you that you want to accept that learning opportunity. I mean, because there are plenty of people in every aspect of show business, from acting to every other part that has a creative bent. When you get negative feedback and when you get something that might be considered a failure, it's very tough to come back from that if you have any sort of ego whatsoever and to learn from that, because you want people, obviously, you want people to like your stuff immediately. And when it doesn't happen, you either go, okay, this wasn't meant for me, or you go, okay, how... are they wrong? Can I keep doing what I'm doing? Or am I really missing an element? And you took from that. Now, so what was the next phase for you?
So the next phase was I had a fortuitous meeting with one of my instructors, Jim Cash, at Michigan State. I had a motorcycle back in Michigan. I was going to drive across country, and I thought I'd go look at Jim, who was a very good teacher. You know, he taught me some minor things on screenwriting. I had one class, the fortune was that the class was full. I had to talk Jim into letting me enroll. You know, I mean, those sort of interesting things. So I met with him at the Michigan State Union. We threw out like 10 ideas. Nothing really clicked. I said, well, okay, well, we'll keep talking. And driving cross country in the middle of Utah somewhere, I said, ooh, that really, I get it. I get what he was talking about. And called him when I got to California and said, yeah, let's develop this idea. So for 2.5 years, we worked on a screenplay together. I mean, both had jobs. We were both, you know, paying bills, and so it was part-time. But we went through 5 drafts, kept saying, not good enough. My experience from Hearts of the West told me that we had to enter the business only at the top. You can't enter the business in the middle. As a screenwriter, you've got to enter where everyone goes, yeah, this is really at this level. So we went through a laborious process until we felt this script was at a high level. Through a friend, we got an introduction to an agent who...
Well, let me ask you, how many versions do you think you did?
If 5.
You can, really?
At least 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did that stay pretty standard over the course of working on scripts?
Well, I always say, you know...
Before you even showed it to anybody?
Yeah, well, in a sense, yes. I mean, yes. I mean, first drafts are not meant to be seen by anybody,
right,
except your closest friends who know you well. That's not what they're for. First drafts are for discovery. First drafts are to find things out, to see what you have.
It's just to get something on paper. I mean, probably, and it always has been. Is that the toughest draft for you, just to puke it out?
Well, I think any time you're facing a blank page is really hard.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to just start putting things down and just start, you know. Yeah. I'm a very prep guy, so I like to prep before I write. I like to know a lot of things before I start putting words to paper. I like to know who the characters are, the story. I like to know what the structure is going to be. I work out all the scenes.
So you're a meticulous detail guy.
Yeah.
What was Jim's part of the equation?
Jim wrote wonderful dialogue.
Okay.
He studied the dialogue of the 40s, the romantic comedies, and so yeah. he had a flair to have that type of repartee that is rare to see.
Those are the best partnerships, right, where you bring completely different perspectives to
it. We called it a words and music partnership.
Yeah.
And so it really was.
Did you jive the whole time you worked together?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Well, one thing, we lived in two different places. Jim lived in East Lansing, Michigan, and I lived in Santa Monica. So it kept us friends and not having a lot of fights.
Right. Not being in the same room.
Yep. Yeah. If we didn't agree on something, we hung up the phone, we thought about it, called each other an hour later, and we usually found something. Yeah. You know, we believe that passion ruled. It wasn't like my idea or your idea. It was who was the most passionate.
Right.
And who had the strongest instinct for it. Because
if you fought hardest for your idea, the other one would acquiesce because it obviously meant a lot.
More, and we had good partnerships are built on trust and faith and instincts and having like-minded tastes. I think I don't think you can have two separate tastes and work together. In the end, you can have different influences. Jim and I love the same movies. We reference the same ideas. We went to Billy Wilder all the time. When you're in doubt, go to Billy Wilder. He worked it all out, and it's just a matter of figuring out how I approached it.
There you go. So I love the dynamic of the partnership because I think when I talk to people who are part of one and when it mm-hmm. works, there is an interesting structure to it, which is similar sensibility, similar inspiration, similar background, at yes. least creatively, but completely different sometimes methodology
right.
that complements each other. That's right. interesting.
I think it works best because that way you're basically creating this one whole mm-hmm. as opposed to being competing. You can't be competing, well, my line of dialogue is better than yours. That just doesn't work.
No.
And Jim wrote wonderful dialogue. And the frustration was whenever movies would get made, invariably somebody come on and do a polish, something like that. The first thing to do is change the dialogue, which
right.
would drive us crazy because right. at the end of the day, his dialogue was so sophisticated and so good that it should not have been changed.
And usually if something needs fixing, it's probably more story points or structure than it is just what people
yes.
are saying to each
exactly.
other.
Exactly.
What was that script that you guys worked so hard on that first pass?
It was called Izzy and Mo. Mm-hmm. It's about two prohibition agents in the 20s based on real guys who dressed up in costume. One would dress up as a woman, dress up as a man. They'd go into a speakeasy to try to, they'd pour booze down their a little bladder, and then they'd say, I have bad news here, and then they'd bust a speakeasy. They were real characters. And so we were influenced by The Sting in terms of structure and
sure.
tone. And,
Oh, God, that script is amazing.
It's a beautifully written script. It really is. And so we learned a lot from that script just in terms of how to build scenes.
Right.
And,
Now, forgive me, did that get made?
Nope.
Okay.
There was a movie of the week that got made. Basically, we had seven unproduced screenplays until our first screenplay got made.
Really?
Yeah.
Seven?
Yep.
And each of them had that somewhat laborious process of writing and rewriting.
Rewriting.
Oh,
exactly.
See
exactly.
what I'm doing there?
We'll get
to
that.
Yeah, it's fine. No, but without talking about my book.
Well, you can talk about your book.
No, it's fine. I just think that rewriting for me, if I look back on it, what was the thing that really made the difference? It's my ability and desire to rewrite. In other words, knowing that you have to do it and knowing that it will get better in the process. And that ability to – and that helped with having a partner because it's rewriting alone is much tougher than rewriting with somebody else because you've got somebody to say, okay, come on.
Right.
So, we were cheerleaders to each other and keeps you in the game. We also had a high standard. And so you can't just take something that at a lower standard that you realize, you're compromising. You're compromising your ideal, and you can't do that.
I think that's important because there are so many scripts, and I talk to so many people who read so many scripts every day and tell me consistently how bad they are, how they're just not finished, they're not complete,
right.
how much work always has to be done. And when a really good one comes across, it may not even be the kind of script they're looking for. They're just so impressed that it is as good as it is, that it's that you walk into that house, it's like, oh, we don't have to do a thing to this one.
Right.
And part of that is because people want their second or third version to be the one, and they're so precious about what it is that they don't want to hack away at it. And for you to have that attitude, that's actually not something a lot of writers, I think, have innately, which is, I expect this to change rather drastically from A to Z. And I think that's important.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think it's a hard mindset to get to. But I mean, part of it is realizing that you discover things along the way.
Right.
It's part of a process of development. You have an idea, the idea sounds good, and then trying to create that into these living, breathing characters with a really good story. I mean, a screenplay is it's 110 pages. It's, you know, it's under 2 hours. A lot of long movies today.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, and it needs to, it's a very specific form that tells a story in a very specific way.
Right.
So, you know, you have to learn how to master these techniques to basically be a good writer, tell your story well. I mean, that's what it's about.
Because the tools are already there. The structure is already there. I mean, there are very few people who can reinvent that structure and come up with something totally unique. The fact is, you've already kind of got the bare bones
right.
of it. It's really about how, you know, trying to tell essentially the same structure we've been seeing forever in a different, unique way with great characters and a great journey and something we quite haven't seen before in a fresh way. That's, I guess, the challenge.
It is a challenge.
Which is also why we don't see that much anymore in movies right now.
Well, that's a whole different issue.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a whole different thing. I mean, the quick of that is that approximately 65%, 70% of box office is international.
Yeah.
So that means our domestic box office is only 30 to 35%. So from corporations' point of view, and they're corporations, these are not, you know, small little movie companies.
You're right.
These are major
You're right.
American corporations, and the movie division is a small little part of their bottom line. They want to make sure that they have the revenue. So which market are they going to play for? They're going to play for the domestic market, or are they going to play for China, for Brazil, for India?
Yeah, it's got to be the ultimate mass
right.
appeal.
So, I mean, and that's, you know, that's changed the whole concept, no. you know.
All right, let's not talk about that. I'll get depressed.
Well, it is what it is.
You know,
but I think it is what it is. And you know, that's just – and then we're seeing the – that's one of the advantages of cable. That's one of the advantages of having internet. There are ways of Amazon. There are – we see changes. You know, Transparent happened through a corporate structure. So these ideas can be done, and people are turning to television
right.
to do them now.
And there is amazing work going on. And also
exactly.
when you see artists, when you see names that you have seen do – you know, really unique, incredible films. Somebody like David Fincher, for instance, who
right.
immediately kind of detached himself to House of Cards. I mean, these guys are looking at that as an avenue where they can tell these bigger stories with these great characters
Absolutely.
And extend them beyond
right.
just that hour and a half or two or 2 hours and 25 minutes or whatever.
Yeah. Dickensian storytelling. I mean,
yeah.
that's really what it is, these long,
right.
these long serial
right.
narratives
right.
that are very interesting, you know, as when the ship arrived in Dickens' time, and people met the boat at the port and said, "Is little Nell alive?" You know, from one of his serials. And people were standing at the dock wanting to know what happened
What's
to little
the
Nell.
Next chapter?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It sounds like us getting our, you know, our streaming our favorite show. What's going to happen?
It's
you know,
absolutely what
yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
So let's get to you guys did click. What was it that got the green light first that really set you guys on the path?
Well, you know, we were fortunate that because our first script was well received, we started getting assignments. And so then we actually sold a second spec, and that brought us attention to Joe Wazan, who's a producer, and we did a script for him called Whereabouts that was seen by everybody in town and got within seconds of getting produced. And then suddenly that fell through. Then we were hired to do Dick Tracy. That went through three directors until that was put on a shelf. And then our
So you're working, making a living.
Yep.
With nothing getting actually
nothing.
On the screen.
Getting close.
Which happens a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Getting close, you know, having people buzzing around it. And then we were offered at an 8 a.m. meeting, I was offered by Jeff Katzenberg 10 ideas or 8 ideas. And one of them was this movie about these fighter pilots in San Diego called Top Gun. So I have my private pilot's license. And at that point, I'm thinking, well, if the movie doesn't get made, at least I'll get a jet ride out of this thing. And as a pilot, if you can get up in a Navy jet, that's really great.
Huge.
So I figured, okay, they'll pay
us. At least
us.
I'll have an experience
exactly,
out of it.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so that then, that was a very interesting research experience because although I'm a pilot, I'm flying straight and level in a little Cessna 150. And believe me, I'm not yanking and banking anywhere. But you fly a Navy jet. And what experience that changed everything for the script was how physical that was. The experience of flying a Navy jet is exhausting. I was drenched with sweat. I was like I'd been on a huge workout and just beaten up because of all those 8 Gs and pulling things on a vertical and your spins and flips, and it doesn't stop. And these guys are just – they could think in ways that, you know, multidimensional.
So it's important for you to actually have that physical experience to understand – that these guys are like athletes. These guys.
That was the key.
Yeah.
I realized, I called my partner and said, wait a minute, we've been thinking about this all wrong. This is a sport.
Where were you before? Where were these guys? Just they were just kind of guys with
bravado.
It's
John Wayne sitting in a thing, because when you saw the movies before, they're all straight and narrow. And even if you saw a Korean War movie, it's from a big distance and you see a plane make a turn. You never really felt the physicality of it.
Yeah, warfare was the struggle, but the physical act of flying a plane seemed like it was no big deal.
Exactly. And and doing the research and meeting these guys and realizing that, yes, these were the coolest guys on the planet, I teased them. I said, guys, you're having too much fun. I'm going to have to call the Pentagon and tell them that you're just enjoying yourself too much. I'm like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. So I said, I'm just kidding. Come on. Don't take that so seriously. But, they were such good guys and so smart. And what they did was amazing that I called Jim and said, look, this is not what we think. This is about a sport. And these are some of the greatest athletes in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were running. Pete Pettigrew, who was our technical advisor, was doing the Ironman before anybody ever heard of it. It was just not known because that's who these guys were. They've changed now in terms of the whole profile has changed because of Tailhook and all that other sort of stuff.
Sure. That's
another story.
Yeah.
And so that we wrote that, and I very specifically said, I'm going to write a script that's going to get produced. I'm going to write this thing. They have to make this movie. And it was turned down. Yeah, they said, when I handed it to the executive, he said, there's too many planes in the sky. Nobody wants to see. Nobody wants to see all these planes flying around. I go, wait a minute, you don't understand. This is 28,000 feet. It's never been shot before. Because we had already talked to the military. We had their approval to use equipment, aircraft carriers, F-14s. They wouldn't give us all the gear because that was post-Vietnam. And anything positive about, the military or something in some positive way, they were desperate for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you turn people around, or did somebody
else?
I didn't.
I then went off and worked for Ivan Reitman on Legal Eagles and said, well, okay, it's another one. Number seven, that's unproduced.
So you just assumed Top Gun was going to go on that pile of...
It did.
Well, we worked hard on that.
It was in the pile.
By the way, how do you walk away from something you've put that much effort into that you truly believe is as good a script? Because you've said it several times now. You and Jim would work at the highest level possible. You weren't going to give anything to anybody until you felt like it was absolutely the best product. And continually seeing it not go anywhere, how do you keep going? Where do you get that from?
You just dig down and keep going. That's all there is to it.
Is that Detroit blue-collar worker ethic?
I think it's part of that. And you just realize that it's going to come. Getting a movie made is really hard. It's really hard.
Stuff you can't control.
You can't control
it. So you still believed you gave them something good.
I know I did. So, I said that they missed it.
Yeah.
And it does happen. I mean, one of the best comedies I wrote, they just missed it. Little did I know, the chief executive of that project didn't have a sense of humor. I'm serious. And he didn't sort of get it. So, and you go like, oh, well, that's great.
He's making comedies.
Exactly. The guy making the decision doesn't have a sense of humor. Good. Wow. I'm sure glad I wasted 6 months on that. But what's interesting with Top Gun, what's different is that the studio had a turnover and a new executive team came in. And they had nothing in the pipeline. So they contacted Simpson Bruckheimer and said, what do you guys have? We need something. They reached up the shelf, pulled out, said, we really want to make this movie. And they said, let's go. Usually they don't because they don't want to make from another administration's work.
The previous regimes, they don't want the stink of something that failed.
Right,
I guess.
Exactly. They didn't develop themselves, so therefore who's going to take credit for it?
Right.
But Frank Mancuso said, let's make this movie. And so they're making the movie, and now suddenly we're writing for Ivan Reitman, we're writing Legal Eagles, and they're making Top Gun, and it was like, oh, who's going to... it's rewrites to do, and so it was being in the middle.
So you went from 0 to 60, if I can use a speed term.
I think about 0 to 200 because we had three films made in 11 months.
Yeah.
Released in
11
months.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we went from 0 to 3 films in 11
months. So what's your mindset? You and Jim, are you like, I mean, are you happy? Are you elated? Are you just stressed? Are you suddenly under the gun a little bit? Are you okay?
Well, what's interesting, and I think from a creative point of view, When you're writing in obscurity, it's amazing because no one's looking over your shoulder.
Right.
Well, once you get a hit movie, everybody's looking over your shoulder. Everybody's looking and seeing what you're doing next. And everybody has 2 cents to put in. Top Gun was not looked at as a major picture. It was just another thing in the development slate. Okay, maybe this is the movie here. Well, suddenly we went from guys working on those, another thing in the development slate, to the major studio movies.
Right.
And so suddenly they're looking over our shoulders. And everybody is it's a bigger piece of the pie. So that became, it's harder because you're sort of not only you're second guessing yourself, but you're getting a tremendous amount of input. And as anybody knows, you know, too many cooks spoil the pot, too much input. So things happen that are somewhat beyond your control in
right,
a sense.
Right.
And decision making process becomes tougher because, okay, the studio wants this. We've got this star attached here, the star. I mean, you know, it's this stuff just happens.
Sure.
It just happens.
For the most part, with these big movies, did you ultimately have a good experience?
Yeah, I had very good experiences with the directors. I found them to be good collaborators. I had, except for one experience, that on the whole I thought was really good. I mean, so
did Top Gun turn out the way you and Jim envisioned it? I mean, close.
That's a fair question. And one level, yes, in terms of the excitement and the flying and all of the energy.
But those guys that you got to experience,
right.
did
they sort of made them more accessible. Let's use that word.
Okay.
They made them a little more high school rather than being astrophysicists. So you know what I mean? And I think it was a right decision. I think from a commercial point of view, and those guys had, you know, Simpson, Bruckheimer, great commercial instincts. And for that movie, the slight changes that were made in terms of the way the characters are presented made it a bigger commercial film.
Sure.
So, and first viewing, I missed the guys that we had created. I mean, it was Maverick, but we created Maverick and Goose and all those characters and Iceman. I mean, it all came out of us. But slightly different tints on those things.
Well,
it's sort of like tinting a shade of a color.
You were trying to reflect the guys you knew and,
right.
and met.
Exactly.
And so they didn't exactly nail that, but you felt there was still a sense of them there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, there's okay. definitely a sense of them there. It was just sort of like you're changing a little bit of the orchestration slightly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but again, I think they were all good decisions that were made there. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, any movie could be made 50 different ways, depending upon who the director is, who the cast is. Casting is essential. So, you know, because if you don't have the right cast, when we were writing Top Gun, we were writing it for Tom Cruise, always for Tom Cruise. We had him in mind from the very beginning.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Well,
okay.
We had been watching him, and I liked what he had done in Risky Business. Everybody
right.
did. And
so
all
you
the,
had a bit of a
right
voice
moves.
To go
I did.
On.
The voice was Tom, always for Tom. And so when I gave it to Simpson Bruckheimer, I told Jerry, I said, think Tom Cruise, which they did. They locked on, said, yep, great cast. They locked on, and then getting Tom at the end of the day was difficult because initially he didn't want to do it. So he wasn't sure. So he said, well, why don't you go up to Point Magoo and have a ride in a jet? So Tom drives up there. He's got long hair. He's on a motorcycle. And these flying guys, they don't care about this
movie
guy.
Star.
Yeah, exactly. So their idea of a good time is to take up a civilian, toss him around like an eggshell and just
probably gave Tom Cruise an extra special ride.
They did. And they want you to puke all of yourself. So,
right.
Of course, he did and puked all of himself and said, I love this, but I've got to do this. You know, so, and then he was
and here he is, by the way, hanging on the outside of plans at 50-something
exactly.
years old.
And he's still playing Maverick.
He really is.
Yeah. He actually, that was a character that he gripped and never quit. He realized that was his persona because he actually, after that, he does Cocktail. He doesn't play the Maverick persona. Not that interesting. And then from then on, he's just totally, once Top Gun comes out, he just plays Maverick.
Why this Top Gun, why is there still such an affection for that film even now? I mean, people continue to discover it, reference it, go back to it. There are lines from it. Can you figure out where in the zeitgeist it just kind of clicked on the right things?
You know, it did come together. It's just one of those. And that's the thing, you can't plan on. It just happens.
Right.
It's an amazing cast. The casting's really good. Tony Scott was the right guy to shoot this movie. It's a great look. You know, there is a lot of
fun to it.
It is a
quintessential 80s
right.
movie.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you ever wanted to sit down with a young person and they go, what were the 80s like? Just put Top Gun on, from fashion to music to
everything.
The look, the style. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it still plays. It's cut tight. It's a short movie. It's really well cut. It looks great. I mean, they shot. There's no visual effects as opposed to some modeling that was done. Other than that, it's all shot in the skies. So,
Jack, who wrote I Feel the Need for Speed?
Well, Jim and I did.
Oh,
so yeah.
But are you going to take credit for it, or are you going to give it to Jim?
I'll give it to Jim.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You could have taken it.
I don't know. I'm not going to take credit for that. No. That's the thing about the dialogue.
There's that dialogue.
The dialogue
thing.
Came, and we, that was pretty good. We liked that one. We thought that was really good.
That's great.
So, yeah.
So you have this great run, and you're working with big directors and big studios mm-hmm. and big studio movies. Dick Tracy did get made.
Yeah, it did. Four directors.
That's a wacky project.
Yeah, it is a wacky project. It's the only one where the screenwriter stayed on as each director moved off. I mean, that was unusual.
Yeah. Boy, that is an oddity. I mean, there's just no other way to put it.
It is an oddity.
It's worth watching just for that. I mean, it's so just a strange film. I don't want to delve too much into
that. No, I agree. And we didn't write it as a musical. And I saw it recently, and it's a musical. And it was not written. It wasn't written for a musical. And it was interesting looking back at it. And at that point, we were not involved. Warren went off and did his own thing like Warren will do. And if you're doing a musical, you got to cut the narrative down. You got to tighten it up so there's room and that plays in. So to me, it goes off at rails.
Another huge hit you guys had, The Secret to My Success. Mm-hmm. Michael J. Fox on a huge run. Again, kind of catching... You know, like a Tom Cruise at the right time, you're catching Michael at the right time, and a comedy. And again, a kind of quintessential 80s comedy, that kind of style. And you guys are doing different. I mean, if you look back at even all the unproduced stuff, you guys are jumping around in genre the whole time.
We did. And part of that is because we had 7 unproduced movies. So therefore, we were writing a bunch of different things depending upon what the job was. So we loved writing comedies. And then when Top Gun came out, we became known as the action guys, which we didn't like as much because it's more fun to make people laugh than it is to blow things up. It just is. Yeah. And it's hard to think of blowing things up in interesting new ways. It's really harder than it looks.
Did you find comedy easier to do?
Yeah, comedy I found easier to do in the sense that if you have a good premise, you have a really good, you know, a source of comedy, that this is where the comedy comes from, then you're having fun creating these moments. And, you know, part of it is you're laughing when you're creating comedy. Because if you're not laughing and having a partner, if you guys aren't playing off each other and seeing where the comedy comes from, you're not writing good comedy. I mean, you got to enjoy the process of it.
So let's get to then your book here, because obviously you become an educator.
Yes.
You are a major part of USC's School of Cinematic Arts, which, as you said, covers this wide range of everything from writing to filmmaking to directing to now television projects. There's a comedy initiative, which I've talked with folks in here about. Good Lord, I wish we had had all those resources when I was there in the bungalows in the bullpen of Moviola's sitting in there, and the digital arts, which obviously has become an integral part of that. But writing for you that's your sweet spot, and you've got this. You want to tell us about the book here?
Yes, I mean part of what I think I do very well, and I have a specific approach to, is rewriting. It's something, as we talked about earlier, I think it was really the difference in my career, my ability to rewrite and my fortitude to rewrite, I think, made a difference. I look back and I say, we just kept taking things to a bigger level.
Right.
And then also working with a partner, I had to figure out an approach, how we were going to rewrite together and how to do things systematically. So I've been teaching. I created the rewrite class at USC, and I decided—
There's a rewrite class?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Oh, you have to—
That's great.
Rewriting is something you need to learn to do. It's not something you sort of just fumble through. And people, the problem is people just sort of stagger through it, and they have one draft and they have another draft, but— Is it better or is it just different?
Right.
And different is not better.
So you have to plan as the details guy, as the structure guy, methodical guy.
Right.
You make it part of the work plan. We're going to write the first draft. We're going to do this. Yep. We're going to do this. You plan it.
Yes.
The rewrite's going to come here. That next rewrite's going to come here.
Yes.
You already have it in mind, so you're not dreading it. You're not worried about it. You know that's where you're going to solve the movie, basically.
Absolutely. And I think with young writers, they don't understand that. They've written a first draft. They're very excited about it. They're very happy that they've written it. And they're, look what I've done.
Yeah.
But I tell all my writers, I said, look, you're going to rewrite this. Stop worrying about it.
Mm-hmm.
Relax. Yeah. Have fun. Write a first draft. Discover what your movie is. Find out who these characters are. Find out what their stories are. Use this as a process to be playful. As opposed to, this is perfect. No, it's never perfect.
No, it's going to suck.
It is going to suck. Very few first drafts come out, really. Sometimes they do, and it just happens, but not too often.
Yeah.
So if you go into it knowing you're going to rewrite, it makes you freer to write a first draft because you don't have the pressure on every line of dialogue. It doesn't have to be good. You're going to go over it. You're going to go over it multiple times.
Again, I also think it makes you less precious about it, too.
Yes.
If you are agonizing over, and I've done this myself, mm-hmm. if you are agonizing over every every line, every page. And then when you go back and you reread everything you just wrote yesterday and start tweaking that in the rewriting in the first draft, for instance, is probably a terrible idea. You just kind of have to move forward.
And that's my approach. Everybody, you know, no one does it the same way
twice.
Eric Roth is somebody who spends a year writing a first draft. Now, that's Eric, and, you know, that's his approach. I couldn't do that. I'd lose my mind, and plus, I don't think that that's – I don't think it's a very good, you know, efficient way to write.
I think a lot of people do that and never get one done.
Well, that's it. They get one done, or by the time you get to the end, they're just – they don't have anything left.
I just
know that I want to find the movie. Part of it is, what is this about? And I think that's what people don't understand. What's your story about, and can you tell it to me in a sentence, in a word? Can you tell me what this movie's about?
Mm-hmm. In a word.
In a word. It should be that clear to you, and it should resonate throughout the entire script. Well, sometimes you don't know it until you get to the end. You've written it and said, okay, now I know what this movie's about.
Because you're discovering who your character
is.
That guy you had to discover at one point, which is, I need to follow somebody on this journey.
Yes.
And they're going somewhere. They're learning something. They're discovering something.
And what's their personal stake in? What do they care about? And why is this character in this movie? What's specific about this? You know, I always say, if you can take a character, so this is Top Gun,
okay?
It's Maverick's movie. Now, let's say I'd say, you know, I don't like this Maverick character. I'm going to, you know, who I like is Iceman. I'm going to take Iceman and make him the star of this movie. Well, that movie's got to change.
Yeah.
The whole movie's got to change. That plot can't work. It can't stay the same. Those scenes have to change because it's a different character with a different story and a different set of experiences that's going to happen to him. So you have to have a character that's very specific and unique to your story.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be that character's story. And so that's a hard thing to do. And it takes many passes. Now, see, part of my approach is that you're better to do a lot of small changes over a series of drafts and trying to fix everything in one big rewrite. You know, you will accomplish little by trying to fix it all. If you can focus on different things, I want to focus on some structure. I'm going to focus on character. I'm going to focus on my theme right now. And then I'm going to blend these together. And through a period of passes, it's sort of like layering. You layer your script.
How many people do you let read your drafts when you're doing this? All right. I mean, do you have a different when you guys were working together? Did you have your kind of stock group inside circle that would?
Well, because we were a team, we had each other.
Yeah.
And my wife was a very good reader, so she'd read for us and that sort of thing. So we'd get good insight. Had good agents. Let an agent look at a draft. Pretty much, we held high standards for each other. We pretty much knew. And then, of course, you're getting notes from
the
studio.
Notes, yeah.
And so at that point, and notes is a whole other game. How do you handle notes? And that's a whole thing to learn, because the notes don't always tell you what you need to fix. They suggest as a symptom, but they don't suggest a solution. So it's sort of like tea leaves.
What's the most frustrating note you ever got? There's got to be one that sticks.
Well, the one there's too many planes in the sky.
I mean,
that was a note like
that's pretty awesome.
And to Simpson Bruckheimer's merit, when we had a meeting with the studio about changes they wanted to make, and one of the executives suggested, and this is one, he said, okay, well, what happens is it's about the plane, that nobody can fly the plane. And see, at the end, Maverick has got to figure out the special technique, and when he figures it out, then he can win the day. And we all looked and said, no, we're not making that movie.
No.
And they basically put it on a shelf and just walked away, because they would not make the changes to get that movie, because they knew that was not the movie.
Yeah.
So,
God, this is great stuff. So Screenwriting is Rewriting is available now?
It's coming out in January.
Oh, great.
But you can pre-order it on Amazon.com right now and be delivered. Be the first one in your block to own a copy. It's actually, you know, it's the first time I've written a book like this, and it's writing a book is hard. I mean, it really is. Writing a script, it's not that it's easy, but it's fun because you can play with fragments and sentence things. You're creating images. But actually, you know, putting things into really well-written sentences is, you know.
Well, it's a completely different structure.
It's a very different
issue.
Structure, yeah.
But this is great, though, because I don't know that anybody's ever approached this. I mean, there are a lot of screenwriting books.
Yes.
And there are a lot of screenwriting books that tell you you're going to have to rewrite your script. But they are almost always about getting that first draft done,
right? Which is at the end of the day not as important as getting your next drafts done,
right?
And so you know, part of it I think is because I've taught it, I was able to lay this out into a format that people can use. Like, here's how you approach this, a systematic approach, because you're doing surgery, and that's how I look at it. You have to preserve what's good. That's the hard thing, is what's good, what works. because you don't want to throw the baby out. You don't want to throw out the things that are working. You want to discover, here's what's working in the draft. This is what I've got to protect. Here's the core idea. Now, how do I work around this to improve everything to bring that up? You know, I always like to think orchestra because I think it's how you bring in, you know, do you bring in the cellos and when do you bring in the, you know, the horn section?
Right.
When does that come in, the brass? And how do you because you want to create a full sound
right.
in your script.
And how do they enhance the melody line that you started
exactly.
with in the first
absolutely
place?
Absolutely true.
Ooh, that's a great
true.
Analogy.
Yeah.
Well, I love that. Is
yeah.
that in the book?
No.
Got to revise.
I think I mentioned it once. I think I do mention it.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, good.
Otherwise, I'm going to send you back for a rewrite.
I've rewritten it so many times. Who knows what's there?
Are you excited about the young talent you're seeing coming
absolutely.
Through?
Absolutely.
Are there like some really
yes.
brilliant young people doing some great
absolutely.
Stuff?
Absolutely. You know, we have the we're fortunate to basically have some of those talented kids apply to our program, and we really see it. And they're dedicated. You know, people are really dedicated to it. And I think television has really excited people in terms of creating really good writing.
We're more than a few industry people have referred to this as a golden age of not mm-hmm. just television, but just of content, that there is some, I mean, there's a ton of content.
Right.
There's probably too much. But in that mix, it certainly seems to have given more opportunities and more avenues for really talented people to make their stuff available. And as opposed to the traditional studio system, it's up, it's somewhere. And it seems like the good stuff is found and the audience responds right. and the cream rises to the crop. That's what's interesting about this new media kind of situation. Any thoughts on that?
No, I totally
I don't
agree.
Mean to pontificate
no,
here.
No, you're absolutely right. I think, and this is not trying to toot writers' horns, but I think part of it is that it's very writer-centric.
Right.
So what that means is that the ideas that are coming out of the Vince Gilligans, the David Simons, are coming directly from them without all of this interference and all of these notes and all of this, here's a great idea, but let's turn it into a different idea. And so you're seeing it coming off the writers just straight out of their brains mm-hmm. and working with very talented writing rooms. So you have a lot of talented people focusing in on all of these things, a lot of thought. And then it's not getting developed to death. And I wish the studio would sort of look at that. I mean, you look at a movie like Whiplash, okay, mm-hmm. Or Nightcrawler. I mean, to me, those are films I really enjoyed last year because they had that creator's edge to it. And they were exciting to look at.
Yeah.
And I think my big fear of movies right now is that they're becoming so formulaic that they're creating an audience that's all they know.
Right.
And therefore, they're sort of turning them off in that. As opposed to, you know, people want something different. They want something they haven't seen before. And that comes from a lot of talent. Filmmakers have something to say and finding different ways to do it, even in big movies.
I feel like we've kind of come full circle from what we were talking about when you were going to see big event movies in Detroit. You know, there was a time in the 50s when television was catching on where the film industry was panicked. And that's where we started seeing Panavision and CinemaScope.
Yes.
And it was, you know, these big, giant, three-hour epic
right.
movies on a huge screen. It
sure.
had to be something big. I kind of feel like we're back to that point now where it's tentpole movies. They have to be IMAX. You have to experience them. And by the way, when they're good, they're amazing. You know,
yeah.
talking about Tom Cruise again, that Mission Impossible movie is a very satisfying action film.
It is.
It's big. It's loud. It's from the moment it starts, you are wrapped up in the thing.
It's well made. It's actually well
yeah.
constructed. I mean, it's a very sort of satisfying big summer movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't break new ground, but it does it well. I
no.
mean, if you like that type of movie, you know, I had a good time.
But
you know?
I have actually gotten over the need, for instance, to go see a Noah Baumbach movie in the theater anymore
yes.
because it's small, it's intimate, it satisfies me
right.
from a creative standpoint, and I can watch it on a relatively large screen in my home.
Yeah, I know. I feel guilty about that.
I do, too,
I know, because
love the theater experience.
I agree, but it ends up becoming so much. My home theater experience is really good. I've got a nice surround
yeah.
sound. I've got a good size screen. And it's you know, I like to see movies that way, the smaller, more intimate ones.
Yeah.
But then we're not supporting it. So that becomes how does that then monetize, to use those corporate words, and not get, you know, marginalized. I mean, you're seeing that. I think, again, it's going to move to television. I think it's going to move to HBO, these event movies.
Right.
You know, show me a hero on HBO, six episodes only.
Right.
David Simon, you know,
yeah.
these sort of things.
You still satisfied in the role, or do you still get a kick out of the creative process and watching young people come up now that you're not necessarily immersed in the business side of it as much anymore? Is it still satisfying?
Yeah, I mean, everybody loves the business. So, you know, you always want to be in the center of the cyclone. You know, it's sort of fun. But this is a very different phase of my life. And I think you go through phases in your life. And
sure.
I think that's part of it. And I can't be happier in the phase I'm in right now. To me, to share my experiences with really young, talented people is a lot of fun. I enjoy the process. I enjoy when they succeed and break through. So in trying to share my wisdom, my experience, you know, is a fun thing. And I'm also surrounded by wonderful colleagues. So it's a great faculty there, people who are filmmakers, who are making things. And I'm still involved. I'm still doing my own creative work. So in writing this book was a lot of fun in terms of, no, it actually wasn't a lot of work, but anyway, to tell the truth. But because it's just hard, you know, it is, all creative work is hard work. You know, as a friend said, you write with your butt. You do, because
right.
if it's not in the seat, you're
yeah.
not writing.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, you know, it's perspiration, not inspiration.
Yeah. From everybody I've talked to in this room who's reached a certain level of success in whatever field they're in, work ethic is huge.
It has to be.
And I think it goes to your rewriting thing, which is you just have to keep doing it. You just have to keep
you
doing
do.
It. The fact that you went through 7 unproduced screenplays and went on to the 8th
right.
just says you got to. It's a craft, and
it
you
is
have
a craft.
To keep practicing it over and over
right.
and over.
It's a craft, and it's an art form. I mean, it's both. Of the art, I think, happens by accident.
Yes.
You know, people don't settle. People settle to make an art movie tend not to. People tend,
or they do, and nobody wants to see it.
But you try to make a good movie. Everyone tries yeah. to make a good movie, and sometimes it all comes together.
Yeah.
It's just the right elements are there. It happens. It's like getting hit by lightning, and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
For some reason, it transcends.
Yeah.
And that's the excitement of it.
Well, you know what they say, Jack. There's no business like show
business.
Show business. And that's your cue.
Oh, there's no business like show business. There's no business I know. Okay.
And that's when I start to fade out. That'll be a beautiful thing. Jack Epps Jr., thank you so much.
Where's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey!